Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I'll ask the marshal to call us in and then I'll just have a few comments.
Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bratfeld, Judge Ross, Judge Schmidt, the Honorable Diane B. Bratfeld presiding.
And good morning again. Today's date is November 15th, 2023. We are proceeding with today's calendar for this panel. We have a total of, six cases, I believe it is, on our calendar today. Three of those are oral, and the oral cases will be heard via Zoom, as indicated in the notice, and as everyone is aware, because we are participating, and counsel for the first case are visible. And I understand you've already done a sound check. You know what to do if for some reason we would lose a connection. And I think you understand that we record today's proceedings, but the recording is an audio recording and made available on the court's website. With that, I'll ask the marshal to call the first case.
Calling cases A221615 and A230754, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Thomas David Fogel Appellant.
And again, as I noted, counsel, I'll just say a couple of quick things. You may already be aware of this. First of all, you'll want to make sure that you have visible on your screen the clock that's counting down the time for our discussion today. It tends to go quickly. We really enjoy speaking with you. Thank you so much for being present today. And then I'll ask you before you start your remarks, please identify yourself for the record as well as the client you represent. I think with that, we're ready to begin. So counsel for appellant, go ahead when you're ready.
Well, good morning, everyone, and may it please the court and counsel. My name is Ryan Pasiga, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Thomas Fogel. I was his trial counsel as well. And I'd like to begin with opening remarks, if I may.
You may, counsel. I meant to add, the court did get a copy of the letter that you sent with regard to one of the issues. So
thank you.
So ahead. I don't need it. Yeah.
Certainly. If there's any questions about that, let me know. Otherwise, I'm going to jump to portions 2 and 3 of my argument. And frankly, I'll focus mostly on section 2, which is this issue of the therapist records. Imagine somebody sees a therapist for years and either fills out a questionnaire, an intake questionnaire, or is screened in their initial meetings with a therapist, such as, has anyone ever touched your private parts? Or has anyone ever sexually assaulted you? Or imagine that when this first disclosure comes to this therapist, there's an allegation of a touch over the private area, but not knowing if it was accidental or not. And then the story changes later, either in how it happened or how many times it happened. Would you, as a juror, want to know that? Would you, as a defendant or a defendant's counsel, deserve to know that? Or would you, even as a prosecutor, as a minister of justice, knowing that a report came from a therapist and knowing that there were visits with a therapist, would you want to know that? And perhaps would this be Brady information if the government was aware of it, even if it didn't technically possess this information? I think that's why this is important. I anticipate that the court's going to ask me, well, why didn't you file a parity motion? Well, that's a good question.
Counsel, I think I would want to know all this information as a juror, defense counsel, or prosecutor, but the question is, does the statute allow disclosure of it? And I didn't see Inree Hope cited in your brief, and that seems to be right on point, as does a recent case out of this court that addresses the same statutory provision. So how do you get around either of those cases?
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, Inree Hope is cited in our brief. It's cited in our brief, but basically, I don't know that Inree Hope applies because it was particular with respect to the definition of a sexual assault counselor. Now, Judge Ross, who later wrote the opinion in Inree Ramirez, which was granted, that was a case where the court entered a writ of prohibition. I noticed that the Supreme Court did grant review of that order from Judge Ross, had authored that. I haven't seen that the Supreme Court has taken any further action on In re Ramirez, but nonetheless, I think you're getting right to the heart of it, Judge Schmidt, in that the question is being, well, are these statutorily protected records, and is there in fact an unpierceable rule without an exception here? And that's where the Sixth Amendment and the right to confrontation, but beyond just the right to cross-examine a witness, but have access to these records or even allow the court to entertain a balancing test such as parity in camera to determine what's appropriate. I think that question is still fair game for our courts. I do not think that In re Hope Coalition prohibits a district court from taking an in-camera look at psychological records, which are considered privileged under our statutes. And respectfully, I disagree with the status of the, and I mean that respectfully, I disagree with the status of the In re Ramirez, or it's called In re State, but it's the Ramirez matter that the Supreme Court had said that it granted review for. And then we have a major constitutional question here about whether or not when
you don't have to be overly respectful, Counselor. we all are subject to review. My question goes to the one you predicted. So let's assume you're right about all of the rhetorical questions you asked, that in fact this would be information that a defendant would be interested in knowing. Talk about the timing. I mean, there's no parity motion. You want two bites at the apple? Are any of the cases that you're referring to cases in this setting?
Yeah, Your Honor, I didn't see it as two bites at the apple. And the reason I say that is this. We were peeling back the layers of the onion in this case. Nobody definitively said that the psychologist that the accuser was seeing was indeed the mandatory reporter. What the court had done was we had first brought a motion to take a look at these social services records. The court, in an order dated, the court, and this court will have access to all of that, but in an order, the district court did take in-camera review of the social services records. And it only furnished the defense three pages, of which all three were heavily redacted, including, importantly, the name of the reporter that initiated all of this. We can assume that this was the psychologist that the accuser had been seeing in this case, but there's no definitive record that that was it. Her father said, well, he thinks this is the psychologist was told this. And then the crazy part was this. So the court shielded that information, even on in-camera review, from the defense. This court should have the full record of what the court looked at and what the court did not furnish to the defense in those social services records, as well as what was heavily redacted. So having not received that information from the district court, even in the social services records, and the court in another part of its order saying that the defense was not even entitled to emails between the prosecution and other government agencies concerning these allegations in this particular case. The district court says you haven't even made a plausible showing that it's material and favorable, even for those records. So we were in a position where we're looking at the district court saying, you haven't even given us the name of the mandatory reporter after in-camera review. You've heavily redacted the three small pages that you gave to the defense in the social services records, and you're telling us that we don't even get to see emails between the government and this state agency concerning this case because we haven't made a plausible showing that they're material and helpful. It is patently obvious that the district court, and predictable that the state, would have been saying, this is a fishing expedition. You cannot make any plausible showing that they're material and helpful, which is always what I call the parity paradox. We don't know what's in the records. The government always says, you don't know what's in there. You're guessing. This is a fishing expedition. You haven't made the showing. The In re Hope Coalition talks about that in a footnote as well. In some of the other cases, it's a fishing expedition. You don't know what you don't know. But what we knew in this case was that she says that she was talking to a prosecutor or the therapist about this. And here's the biggest part I want you to know. the government brought a motion in limine asking that the court permit prior consistent statements for her to be introduced in this trial by the accuser or the victim in this case, right? So they wanted it both ways. They wanted her to be able to testify, which she did at trial, about what she told her therapist. They brought it up in their opening argument. They elicited testimony on direct exam about what she told her therapist. And then everyone wants to say, but defense, you can't impeach her because you don't get these records. So they opened that box, if you will, when they elicited that testimony and brought that motion in limine.
Well, again, I guess it goes to my question. I mean, the challenges being raised after the trial. I mean, these are challenges that could have been made during the trial. Am I correct about that?
Again, we could have brought a parity motion, but for all the reasons I've already said, the court already shot down even us having the name of the mandatory reporter and wouldn't give us other records saying we haven't made a plausible showing of that they're material and favorable when they go to communications between the prosecution and the agency that took the report.
The impeachment argument that you just made, when was the first time the district court was presented with this argument?
In the motion for the post-conviction relief, because now we know that she's testified. She has testified now
Why isn't that too late? I mean, you would have known that she testified during the trial. I mean, it live and in person. And so knowing that there was a therapist involved, knowing that there might be some impeachment value, why is this preserving that issue?
Well, the court had already ruled in its motion in limine that the government was allowed to introduce prior consistent statements and elicit testimony about this. The court granted the government's motion in limine there. The court allowed the witness to talk about what she told the therapist.
I'm not sure that gets to my question as to the objection that I would have expected at that point, which was either an objection or an assertion of a need for the document to perform the impeachment that you're saying your client was entitled to. I mean, if you wait until post-conviction before you ask for evidence for impeachment, it goes back to my original concern about a second bite at the apple for the defendant. Yeah. Disabuse me of my concern.
I think, Your Honor, there was a compound error here. I think it goes first to the redacted records with respect to the social services. I still don't know what's in the rest of those records. You do have an opportunity to see what the court did not only redacted to the defense, but also didn't furnish to us at all. There were more records than those three pages. This is a compounding issue for the court. But now we can look on post-conviction and say, listen, she testified about these things. These very well may be impeachable records that we were not furnished with, that I don't know if the government ever saw them and just did not take position. I'm not saying they did. I just don't know. In other words, did her father bring in the records and a victim's advocate or a prosecutor or an officer see these and say, well, we don't want them? I don't know what happened there or not. What I do know is that if we're looking at trying to get this right, I mean, we've got a man who's sitting decades in prison now for a conviction here. If she said something materially different to her therapist about how this happened or how many times it happened or what happened, don't we all want to get this right? And what's the harm in the district court saying, you know what, now that she's testified about these things, I do see a need that's material and favorable to take a look at what could be helpful for the defense here. And if the court orders those records and looks at those in camera, the court will be in a position to say, aha, there is a major issue here. This is materially different than what she told law enforcement or in her forensic interview or testified about or not. But maybe she didn't.
The harm would be piercing the privilege. And so I get the idea that it would be beneficial to have these records, but it's not the state's privilege to waive. And I apologize, you did cite Henry Hope. I see that in your brief. But Ramirez is still controlling on us. And that case got dismissed after the Supreme Court granted review. So that is controlling. So how do we get around Ramirez?
I think I can argue at this point then for a good faith change in the law. I mean, we've got a major Sixth Amendment issue here, as the court knows in the Ramirez situation, right? Is this an unpierceable privilege other than the legislative exception, or does the Sixth Amendment and due process demand instead? Because we're focusing on a victim's right here when we're making these arguments. And I think that focus is misplaced. This is about a defendant's constitutional rights under the Bill of Rights. This is about a fair trial for the defendant. And the idea that victims won't go to a therapist, that their speech will somehow be chilled and they won't want to disclose a sex assault to a therapist, not to a sex assault crisis center now, that their rights are somehow more important than a defendant who's accused of these things, when this is the evidence. She's the person. There's no forensic evidence here. There's no other witnesses here. This is her word against his about what happened. She was the key witness in this case. And the only way to impeach her or to get to the truth about what happened or not is to get all of this information out. That's why law enforcement wants to interview subjects of an investigation. And the first thing they do, if a defendant speaks to law enforcement and a defendant later testifies in trial, and if that defendant testifies differently in trial, everybody says you must be lying because your version is different than what you said before. That's one of the cruxes of cross-examination, is were there other versions of a story given at another time? And this focus needs to be on the rights of the accused. Our entire criminal justice system is built upon that bedrock principle, the presumption of innocence, the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, the right to a fair trial. Well, These are the rights.
I totally understand your policy arguments and your idea of a good faith change in the law, but how can we, as the intermediate court, say Hope was wrong or we're not going to follow Ramirez, which is a precedential opinion from this court issued not too long ago?
You can look at it in this particular case under these particular facts would be my answer, respectfully, Your Honor. I'm out of time here, but I'll talk to you on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, we're ready for you when you are.
Thank you and good morning. My name is Jeff Albright. I represent the state of Minnesota in this case. I was also the trial counsel. Because I don't have a rebuttal opportunity, I do want to just talk about two points. Mr. Pasiga brought up the fact that the state motion for prior consistent statements, and he alluded to prior consistent statements of what the victim in this case told the therapist. That isn't accurate. The state brought up prior consistent statements because we knew that the victim was going to testify. And there was also a forensic interview that was provided and disclosed to Mr. Pasiga. In order to get that forensic interview, which is an out-of-court statement offered to the truth of the matter that it asserts, had to file a motion for or notice of a prior consistent statement to be able to present that to the jury. Second point was two bites at the apple. This absolutely is looking for two bites at the apple. What this is doing is ignoring procedure and process, going to a trial, shedding light on the fact that, or arguing that the state didn't meet its burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt because the investigation wasn't complete. The investigation wasn't complete because the therapist wasn't interviewed. There's no notes, no records. And that's what Mr. Pasiga argued at trial. Now, learning hindsight that wasn't viable, the district or the jury rejected that and said the state did meet its burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, found Mr. Fogle, the appellant in this case, guilty of all charges, now filing a post-conviction petition and arguing that there's some sort of discovery violation is exactly two bites at the apple. I did want to specifically note that there is no discovery violation in this case. That has been withdrawn by counsel, as well as the record is clear, and the district court found there was no discovery violation. In addition, the state was never in possession or control of any therapy records, notes, or otherwise. In addition, the state did not have control over this third-party therapist, so had no obligation or no legal authority or requirement to try to obtain these records from the victim's therapist. Not only that, there's two important points. And as this court alluded to already, appellant did not file a parity motion to make it a proper review for the district court, as well as didn't request a subpoena to try and obtain these specific records. Had appellant wanted to obtain these records prior to trial, which was known, right? One of the witnesses provided the therapist information to law enforcement. That was disclosed to counsel. So the therapist was known. Whether or not that was the mandated reporter or otherwise, that is not known. However, that was known, and he didn't file a parity motion, believing to be a tactic or strategy at a trial, rather than getting these therapy records, if they existed, showing that they are consistent, then that argument is out the window. Instead, he's alluding to and wanted to at trial provide the jury with some sort of doubt because the investigation wasn't complete. We don't know what these records would say. Therefore, the state didn't meet its burden. That's not the correct process and procedure that is required to obtain these records. There's also another way to obtain records from a third-party therapist, and that is to file a subpoena. I know that there is an unpublished 2016 Minnesota Court of Appeals case, State versus Goldtooth. And I understand that it's unpublished. I did cite that in my brief. And that's the exact situation we have here, where appellant was convicted. Prior to a trial, a parity motion was filed. The district court denied that parity motion based on being a fishing expedition, overly broad, not narrowed in scope. After a conviction, the appellant in that case filed a post-conviction petition. The district court denied that petition, and this court affirmed that decision. Now, our case is more or stronger than that of the unpublished Goldtooth decision, in that the district court in Goldtooth had a parity motion that it ruled on. This case, there is no parity motion, as well as no subpoena. Because the record is clear that there is no discovery violation, the state doesn't have any control and never had any of the records, and there's no legal obligation for the state to seek out these records on behalf of the appellant, the district court did not abuse its discretion in denying a post-conviction petition in this case.
I just want to make sure I'm clear on the record. The prior consistent statements of which your was introduced at trial came from the sergeant's interview with the victim. Is that right?
Yes, it came from the victim's forensic interview with the sergeant. Yes.
Okay. Was there any prior consistent statement introduced about therapy?
Specifically about what did you tell your therapist or something like that? I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that there was conversations about she's attended therapy and she sought a therapist since she was 12 years old and has been on and off since then, but not to my knowledge about what she told her therapist, at least from the state's perspective. It may have been alluded to on cross-examination, but not from the state. But ultimately, even if there was, that doesn't change the analysis in this case, because there was no parity motion. The state didn't have possession of it, and there's no legal obligation to allow, in this case, to have a evidentiary hearing on a post-conviction of known issues, which just opened the door for the appellant or defendants to go to trial on one theory, then afterwards claim a discovery violation based on unknown records, and then get a new trial on a completely different theory. That's not the process, and that's not what our legal or our case law supports. I didn't read anywhere in appellate's brief, and the state could not find any, that supports a parity motion after a trial is appropriate on post-conviction. The record is clear. There was no violation. There was no possession by the state of these records, and there's no legal obligation to obtain them. So I would ask the court, this court, to affirm the district court's decision on that issue. And I'm going to move on to the last issue before this court. Appellant argues that the district court abused its discretion when it denied appellant a mitigated dispositional departure. Now, departures are discouraged under the law and are only intended to apply to a small number of cases. Importantly, the district court must pronounce a presumptive sentence unless there exist identifiable, substantial, and compelling circumstances to not do.
When you say departures are, I believe your word was discouraged under the law. What exactly do you mean by that? I mean, and departures are encouraged if there's a substantial and compelling reason to depart.
Thank you. Yes, they are, and I wouldn't say that they were encouraged. I would say that even when. Sorry, I didn't hear that.
They're allowed if there's. Yeah. And it's expressly allowed. So I mean, if it's true that there are substantial and compelling reasons to depart, I don't know that it is accurate to say that they are discouraged in that circumstance.
Sure. Well, kind of where I came up with that, and I did cite that in my brief, and I provided the case for it, but a departure is a may. It's not a must. And as you alluded to, Your Honor, that it is allowed. However, even if there exists substantial and compelling circumstances, there is no requirement in our law for the district court to, in fact, order a departure. And I cited that.
I agree with that, but I don't know that that supports the premise that they are discouraged in that circumstance.
Well, I analogize it as they're only intended to apply to a small number of cases because I look at it under the umbrella that they are presumed. The guideline sentence is the presumption. In order to,
I think you're right about that. I think we're seeing eye to eye, but Mr. Basiga's argument is that this is one of those cases where there are substantial and compelling reasons, and so it wouldn't be discouraged in this case.
The district court didn't award that departure, so we got to look at it from that lens. The district court determined and weighed those factors that were present, and that is pretty clear in the record here, that even when there is substantial and compelling circumstances, there's no requirement to depart. Really, Mr. Pasiga's argument is because the district court did not depart, he must have abused his discretion. That's his argument, because he can't argue that the district court did not deliberately weigh or consider the factors that were present in this case. The district court heard arguments of counsel, reviewed the PSI, reviewed letters submitted on behalf of appellant, approximately 41 of them, listened to a victim impact statement, considered the impact of appellant's conduct had on the victim, considered deterrence of appellant and others. The district court even went through and considered appellant's age, lack of criminal history, support of friends and family, as well as lack of acceptance of responsibility and lack of remorse. Even after all of those factors were present in this case, the court took a 15 to 20 minute break to consider all factors, then came out and pronounced sentence. And when it pronounced the sentence, it weighed his age, his lack of acceptance. And that is clear in the record. And just because the argument by Mr. Pasiga is simply, well, if you weigh all these factors, they, in his argument, would be that they do weigh in favor of a departure. However, the case law does not require the court to depart even when there is, as argued by Mr. Pasiga, substantial and compelling reasons. It's not required. So there is no abuse of discretion as long as the district court deliberately and carefully considered the factors present. And there can be no merit to the argument that the district court didn't. They cited in their brief many situations in which the court laid out specifically that his age doesn't weigh in his favor, that he lacks remorse and lacks responsibility for his actions, even after the conviction, that he does have the friends, support of family, and that anyone in this situation would have friends, support of family, as well as the letters, and still determined that it was not justified to award a departure based on Mr. Fogle's conduct, and sentenced him to a guideline sentence, not an aggravated departure, sentenced him to a guideline sentence. And because the district court made a thorough review and weighed those factors and considered them, as demonstrated in the record, this court should not exercise its discretion to say that this is one of those rare cases that needs to be overturned because of the sentencing decision, the sentencing court's decision. And therefore, I would ask that this court affirm the district court's decision. If there's no more questions, I don't have anything further to present to this court.
Any questions from the panel? Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We will reset the clock, Mr. Pasiga. So you have, there we go, 5 minutes for rebuttal. You can go ahead when you're ready.
I was hoping I got to steal the rest of his time. All right. I'll get to a couple things that Mr. Albright had talked about in his argument. Number one, this subpoena issue, the comments to Rule 22 of the Rules of Criminal Procedure, at the end of the rule are the comments, and it's not right after 2201. It's really after the very end of Rule 22. And embodied in those comments, it says that this process for the subpoena is to formalize the process as set forth in State versus Parity and State versus Hummel. So in other words, this subpoena issue is no different than the Parity. The subpoena issue makes you do Parity. It makes you make that showing. So this is not an alternative way to try to go get these records. You still have to make that showing.
In your research, were you able to find any case in which this court or the Supreme Court reversed the conviction based upon a post-trial effort to get a Parity process?
I'm not aware of anything there, but I'm also not aware of anything that prevents it. You know, what we have here is we know now, after peeling back the layers of the onion, including in the testimony in trial, and pages 57 through 58, Your Honor, Judge Schmidt, you asked a question about, was there testimony elicited regarding the therapist? It was brought up in the state's opening argument a little bit. And then pages 57 and 58, and I'm talking about the actual transcript page numbers as provided by the court reporter. If the appellate page numbers are different, I'm sorry. I'm talking about the actual transcript numbers, all right? But that was the direct examination of the alleged victim, or the now what would be called the victim in this matter, since there was a conviction, okay? But at any rate, it all goes back to the Parity. Now, I go back to the bottom line. What is it that is so harmful here about asking the court to say, listen, now we've got testimony about what she told the therapist. The state never tried to get those records. I mean, I didn't hear Mr. Albright say the state never saw them or nobody told them what was in these records. And I'm not saying that he did or didn't. I don't know. But I didn't hear him say that. That was conspicuously absent. I do understand that he said he didn't have possession and control of those records. And I believe him there. But it doesn't mean they didn't know what was in the records. But at the bottom line,
counsel,
is we've got to...
If I could just ask one question, because I feel like I'm missing something in your argument. I just want to give you a chance to explain. So
sure.
I think you're pointing us to the spot in the transcript where there is some reference to these records, right? Or the therapy, that therapy occurred. Right?
Yeah, that she had told her therapist about it.
Okay. And so if that's true, mm-hmm. expressly mentioned during the trial, and I know you tried to give your answer to Judge Ross, and I just feel like I'm missing something here. Mm-hmm. I don't understand why you were not obligated at that point in time or shortly thereafter, certainly before conviction, to have sought the records. Didn't that give you notice and the need? I mean, it really goes back to, isn't this all just too late? And I'm struggling to understand why it's not too late to raise it post-conviction.
Understood. And that is, again, because the district court, it redacted the reporter's name. Presumably, the reporter was
I don't understand why you need the name. I'm struggling with that. I've seen many, many discovery classes. They don't always include names.
My point is this, Your Honor, if the district court is not even going to give us the name of the therapist who was the reporter in these child protection records, that where this report originated, if you will, and if the district court was going to heavily redact 3 pages out of how many that they had and not give us everything there, it was crystal clear that the district court was not going to give us any of these therapy records. The court even said you can't even get the emails between the state and the child protection because you haven't made a plausible showing that they're material and helpful with regard to their communications about the investigation of Tom Fogel in this case. If that isn't even material and helpful, if that isn't even, how in the world can we say when the court knew she talked to a therapist? If they weren't willing to give us even the therapist's name in these records, is this person who reported this? There's no way the court was signaling to us, you're not going to be able to make this showing under parity. And so I just don't know what the harm is if this is not, in my view, having two bites at the apple. What I think this is really about is let's all get this right. Don't we want to know if she had a very different statement to her therapist about what happened? Don't we want to know that?
Right. Counsel, you can see your time is up. Thank you, though, very much. We appreciate hearing from you. We appreciate hearing from both lawyers in this case.
Thank you to the court. Thank you to the court for your service and to counsel as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to let the parties know that this matter is now submitted to this court for a decision, and we will issue a written decision within the statutory timeframe. Thank you.